What if I told you that the biggest IPO in history, a company worth more than $1.5 trillion, could not get into the S&P 500? And that the rules that kept it out may have just saved you money? Keep listening as we dive in. Welcome to the Money Meets Medicine podcast, where we talk all about the personal finance topics you wish you had learned in medical school. I'm your host, Justin Harvey, and here is your co-host, who built his first rocket using AutoCAD in high school, Dr. Jimmy Turner.
So that was such a fun class. I took a class in high school, got to use AutoCAD. I'm not an engineer, by the way. Obviously, I'm an anesthesiologist and financial literacy person, but I really enjoyed it. My dad was a nuclear engineer, so I had some engineering DNA, and we used this program called AutoCAD to build rockets. And then the class responsibility, the object of the class was to build a rocket that went the highest. And I'm pretty sure I won. My rocket went the highest in the class. I was very proud of that at the time in high school as a freshman. And at Lecanto High School, back before I transferred to Crystal River, for any of the rare people that happen to be listening to this, know where those high schools are in Florida. But it was a ton of fun. I actually really enjoyed it. Did you build or launch some rockets at some point, Justin?
My brother and I did spend some time launching model rockets from the baseball field of the elementary school that we went to way back in the 90s, back when kids did fun things in the 90s that were like slightly dangerous in the physical world. Now it's all about being dangerous on the internet or whatever the kids are into these days. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a different world we're growing up in now, but this show is going to be about rockets in a way, which is why we talk about this. So we're talking about SpaceX. And listeners, obviously, we don't normally do episodes on single stocks or single companies. And obviously, Justin, you know that we're index fund people. We like that. And I have said on the show many times, more than I can count, that, hey, what should I buy? Hey, just why don't you just go buy something cheaply that does what the index does and then save your time to do other things in your life that you care about. And I know that, Justin, you don't necessarily from a financial advisory standpoint, do a quote unquote index, but you mirror an index in what you do as your practice.
Yeah, indexing is an oversimplification and perhaps a misrepresentation of my personal philosophy, although it's directionally more like indexing than anything. And actually today we're going to understand exactly why indexing can be problematic.
Yeah, and I'm super excited to talk about it because preemptively we are going to talk about SpaceX. So this is not financial advice. I'm going to say this for Justin because he's a financial advisor. We need disclaimers on this. There's one all the way at the end of the podcast if you want to listen to that as well. These are not recommendations for you, but general education. And I think this is a really good one to discuss because SpaceX IPO'd recently. So we're going to talk about what an IPO is, how they work, how stocks are chosen to be included in an index fund after an IPO. And the reason to discuss this is that every once in a while, the market runs an experiment in public, and it's kind of happening right now where SpaceX is this poster child of how should we determine if something makes an index? Should it make an index? And how does it impact things in your bottom line and also in Wall Street? So we're going to chat about that because I think it's a really important topic. We'll talk about why this became something on my radar here in just a minute. But before we do, it is that time of year, by the way, if you're an incoming med student listening to this, or you are someone who has student loans already, you're looking to refinance, or a med student that's incoming, you now have to deal with the $200,000 federal borrowing limit and you're looking for private loans to help you accomplish your medical school goals. If that fits your current situation, I encourage you to treat finding your private student loan rates more like shopping at Costco than going to a grocery store. And the reason for this is because you can often find lower interest rates when you use group negotiation processes with the private lenders than if you go to them directly, like bulk discount pricing at Costco. So honestly, brilliant idea. First time I ran into it, and I heard about it from Juno. So if you are looking to privately refinance your loans or to get private loans while you're in medical school, I encourage you to check out Juno by going to moneymeetsmedicine.com/Juno to learn more about their group negotiation process. It's like Costco for student loans, and how to find a lower interest rate using that for your med school loans. So Justin, here's the backstory. My sister, who's an amazing human being, was my business manager at The Physician Philosopher for multiple years when I was running a coaching business. Also named Kristen, ironically. So my grandfather used to call her IN. My wife's name is Kristen, so it's a little awkward to be married to the same name that your sister's name is, but that is my life. And the jokes. That's right. So IN, my sister, sent me a couple of videos on Instagram. And I'm obviously a big frequenter of Instagram at this point. So if you haven't checked out the channel, check it out. It's almost 100,000 followers at this point. But she sends me this video and she's like, hey, Jimmy, you need to check this out. And it's about SpaceX and their IPO. And it kind of comes across a little bit like a conspiracy video. But the more that I listen to it, I'm like, no, this isn't really conspiracy. This is just kind of what's happening. And it was a fascinating take, because the video was about how SpaceX, who's owned obviously by Elon Musk, and the variants that go into that, the other companies that go into that, and how they were making a push to get this fund, this stock, on an index And they were going about it in a way, basically asking for special exceptions and rules so that SpaceX could be indexed and access institutional money and these big pools of money from an index that they would otherwise not be able to receive. And that the reason for that had to do with people that had privately invested in Tesla and SpaceX and the online ability capabilities from space that are provided through that company. And they were trying to access this money in a way that had never been done before. And I thought, that's really weird. That seems like a strange thing to make an exception about. I wonder if this is true. And it turns out very publicly, this is in fact true. And so this kind of made me ask the question from a financial literacy standpoint of how do companies make it onto an index? How do they become one of those quote unquote acceptable companies with a large enough market cap to be in these places that people who are putting large swaths of money into an index fund are going to indirectly invest in them by investing in an index fund? And the more I dug into it, the more I realized, oh, this is really is actually a thing that's happening in current modern day times as SpaceX has just recently IPO'd. So I thought this was a great topic for conversation.
Yes. And turns out that now we realize, so this is a perfect sort of launching off point to talk about indexing. I believe in indexing by the index. What are we talking about? Are we talking about the S&P? Are we talking about the Russell 1000? Are we talking about NASDAQ or Dow Jones or CRSP or MSCI or any of these other indexes? And for our listeners who are just listening and putting this in air quotes now, because an index is really just a marketing wrapper created by a company who wants to sell a product. And all these indexes are different. And many of them have overlap in philosophy and in construction, but there are important differences. And we're going to kind of poke at one of those differences today, which is inclusion of mega cap tech IPOs, which is very much the topic du jour these days.
Yeah. So for some background here, why this is happening, why this conversation is happening. And I will say that this is going to drop on August 12th. We record these episodes in advance. And there's a very important timetable that happens on, I want to say, the August 6th or 7th timeframe when it comes to SpaceX in terms of lockouts being over. And so it'll be a very interesting listen being a week after that happens in terms of things that often happen with IPOs that we're going to discuss about in a second. But SpaceX priced its IPO at $135 per share on June 11th of 2026 and began trading on the NASDAQ the next day under the ticker SPCX. So SpaceX, right? It raised $75 billion. That is, for the record, the largest IPO ever. It overshot a prior Saudi company by roughly $29 billion. So it was $29 billion versus $75 billion. That was $29 billion in 2019 versus $75 billion today in 2026 dollars. One unusual wrinkle that happened is that roughly 30% of the offering was reportedly directed to retail investors. So retail investors being the average Jane and Joe had the opportunity to invest in this IPO. And it's normally offered to single digits. When an IPO is made, offered to single digits percentage-wise to the regular investor, it's normally sent to much larger trading organizations, Schwab, Fidelity, you name it. But this time, a lot of regular people, possibly some of you listening to this, had a chance to buy stock in an IPO in SpaceX. That almost never happens. And so this is a big deal because it's very different than normal. And SpaceX includes some things that you've heard about. So Starlink, for example, is a part of this. And they did have a significant amount of revenue. So about 61% of 2025 revenue in SpaceX came from that. And that's up from prior years. But the business as a whole is losing an enormous amount of money, a net loss of $4.9 billion in 2025. And in the first quarter of 2026, $4.3 billion. So when we're talking about what companies get included on an index, I just want to paint that picture for you because SpaceX brings in lots of money, but it loses an enormous sum of, it is not profitable, okay? And so how does a not profitable company get included in something that you get forced to own as an owner in an index fund? And oh, by the way, an even greater reason to have this conversation is that things like Anthropic, which owns Claude, and OpenAI, which owns ChatGPT, will likely be IPOing sometime in the next 6 to 12 months, most people think. So this may be the first of these, but it's not the last of companies that are potentially not profitable, but have massive earning potential and are now considered part of an index as an IPO because of how big their name is prior to them being made public. So this is going to happen again. This is the first, but I bet it's not the last.
Yeah. And I will say that I was hearkening back to my early days in my career whenever Facebook was IPOing. And I remember taking these calls from Grandma Smith, who never looked at her portfolio or had any opinions about anything. And all of a sudden they were coming out of the woodwork to say, hey, can we get in? Can we get a piece of this action? And over the 17 years or whatever since that happened, it would have worked out for Grandma. But this has very much been in the public eye. And as a result, it's actually drawn some scrutiny towards index inclusion and even spawned interesting philosophical conversations about what is indexing and how do you choose an index? If I just want to index, what index am I talking about? And as it relates to the mechanics and the sort of the conspiracy theory about inclusion, I would say this is an interesting and deep rabbit hole, but not even for reasons relating to SpaceX, more for reasons relating to controlling the global economy. Which,
sure.
If you look at institutional investment in, so it comes down to who owns a company and how you have seats on a board, company governance, percentage of ownership. Often there's these huge, like BlackRock and Vanguard and Fidelity, these in some cases privately held companies that BlackRock is public, Fidelity is private, Vanguard is a mutual company. So they're not all the same, but the point is they can determine corporate policies for very big, important companies that are integral to the global economy, that are in some cases involved in military and defense spending or important healthcare decision-making. And so there's a whole set of questions around that are worth asking. I think as it relates to, is it weird that SpaceX was like asking for, I'm not privy to the conversations that they were having with the people making these decisions at the indices. I think I don't blame a dog for barking and I don't blame a duck for quacking and I don't blame Elon Musk and SpaceX executives for trying to have the broadest pool of institutional money possible to buy the shares that they wanted to offload. So personally, I don't find that concerning. I think for the everyday investor, this is a good opportunity to refresh yourself on the philosophy that underpins your investment approach to say, what am I investing for? What time horizon is in play? What do I need my portfolio to give me in order to reach financial independence? And specifically, what role does an individual company play in me reaching those goals? And you can probably tell by the series of questions that I'm asking, it can't possibly matter what SpaceX does in order for you to reach your goals if you invest in a diversified manner. And often these mainstream media is designed to monetize your attention. And so when they tell you these scary things or try to push FOMO on you, look, everyone's getting into this IPO. And it's been very interesting, Jimmy, over the month and change that SpaceX has, that's the rise and fall, and it hasn't fallen all the way down to zero. I think peaked out at just around $3 trillion, which would have made it the fifth largest company based in the US behind just a couple of the household tech names. And now it's been cut in half from that height.
Longtime listeners of Money Meets Medicine know that I don't recommend other businesses or services lightly. And that's because this entire platform was built out of my desire to prevent others from being harmed like I was by bad advice and bad actors in the financial space. This is one reason I say no to over 95% of pitches that I get for advertising and sponsorships on Money Meets Medicine. But some partnerships are no-brainers, like recommending the same company that I use in my own personal life. For example, working with Gelt for my tax strategy is set to save my family more than $40,000 per year in taxes compared to my old CPA, who only touched base in February or March each year. Gelt, on the other hand, is a proactive, tech-forward tax strategy company, and I could say, from experience, that their customer service is incredible. So if you're a locum stock or a practice owner, partner getting a K-1, surgery center owner, or maybe you're a W-2 physician with a 5 or 6 figure side income, you need more than a CPA who just checks in February or March. You need a modern CPA firm built for business owners and high earning professionals with a strong specialization in physicians. Summer is the easiest time to switch, and Gelt is built for that transition. Dedicated tax strategists, real human expertise, technology doing the grunt work in the background, to make it even more of a no-brainer than it already is for the docs that fit that bill. Money Meets Medicine has partnered with Gelt to offer a 10% discount on your first year services when working with them. Head over to moneymeetsmedicine.com/CPA to schedule a call and get that 10% discount when you do so. Now back to the show. So there's so many things to unpack in this episode, and I think it's really such a fun topic to talk about because, so SpaceX started at 135. We talked about that. So June 12th, got up to $161, so up 19%. June 16th, all-time high of 225. July, it's back down to 135. And July 28th, which is just a few days before we're hitting record on this episode, it's at an all-time low of $107. And so this is an interesting thing. So this is the blending of, in my mind, and correct me if you feel differently, Justin, but of private investing and public investing. So what was SpaceX before an IPO? SpaceX was a private company that had certain amount of people that bought into the company. They provided money, support, resources, and as a part of that, got equity in that company as a private company before it went public. So an initial public offering. It was not public yet. That's what an IPO is, right? And so these people, they may have been investors for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, however long SpaceX has been around. I'm not a SpaceX historian, but been around for a long time. And so you can imagine if you're somebody who put a lot of money back in a company before it was really well known, it was a household name. And let's say you put $100,000, $500,000 in this company to get it off the ground. And you've been waiting for 10, 12, 15 years to see that $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 become worth something. You can't access that money in a private company until there's a liquidation event. So until that company gets sold or an IPO happens or there's a merger or acquisition of some kind, that money that you gave is basically locked away in a vault. And so you can imagine for these people that put money into SpaceX and to Starlink and to these other companies that are held as subsidiaries or whatever underneath that main company that have been waiting for a decade to get their money back and their return on investment. The second that this thing goes public, what often happens, not always, but what often happens is these people are saying, hey, I finally have an opportunity to get my money back plus the return on the investment that I made. And so what happens in these situations a lot of time is that these companies get valued and there is a spike and there's a subsequent drop as these private investors who now have a chance to get their money back are going to be able to do so. And so now there's a lockout period where they can't do that for a certain number of days. And so the market will often just kind of preemptively guess at what the rate's going to be or what the price is going to be after those sales happen. But the point is that when you invest in an IPO, you got to realize that the money you're putting in is very likely going to be paying for the money that these private investors are expecting to get out at the other side. Because it's a zero-sum game where you put money in and the people that are selling the stock, which are probably the private investors who've been investing for 10 years, are getting their money out. And so it is very common, not always, can't ever say always or never in finance, but it is not uncommon, I should say. That's true. Yeah, I just broke my own rule. Fair enough. Logical fallacy there for the philosophy major. 1 point to Justin. But my point is that it is very common for a price to spike and then to subsequently fall down after an IPO as people expect these private investors to be taking their money out as you're putting your money in.
So I am most closely associated and familiar with the research that Dimensional Funds has done on this topic because we use Dimensional pretty heavily at APM Wealth. And they agree with everything you just said, essentially, or at least the distilled version, which is there is not a statistical reason to invest at IPO where we have reason to believe that it's going to be accretive to your overall portfolio performance. It is more often detrimental. And therefore, exclusion for a period of 12 months is what, looking at historical data sets, makes more sense. And so a fund manager like Dimensional Funds, who they're kind of like indexing in that there's broadly diversified solutions, but there's also these value judgments that are more academically grounded, would, for example, so if you compare VTI, the Vanguard ETF that is based on the CRSP index versus a constructed instrument like a similar Vanguard or Dimensional equity ETF, hold those sort of in each hand, the Dimensional fund is going to say, we're not even going to look at SpaceX for a year. And in some cases, that creates a performance differential. So I was just looking at the S&P versus Russell 1000 return for the last month, and there was a small amount. We're talking, and again, we're so in the weeds, but it's helpful mathematically to understand. There's a very small amount, somewhere between 4 and 6 basis points of attribution to the delta. So the S&P beat the Russell over the last month, the Russell 1000. These are both US large cap, very similar indices in terms of the composition. Russell says, we're going to include SpaceX. S&P says, we're not going to include them. And the S&P has done a little better because in the last month, SpaceX has flew too close to the sun and had its wings melt, at least in the short term. And it's important to note this is all short-termist, but that creates a performance differential.
But let's talk about it and maybe get out of the weeds for a second and make it more big picture, right? So how is something included in an index? Because this fundamentally got me to ask the question, because I found this interesting as I was researching for this episode, that, for example, SpaceX is not included in the S&P 500. SpaceX is included in a total stock market index fund. And so if you have VTI, for example, or VTSAX, those are total stock market index funds that, because of the industry they follow and the rules that were determined because of SpaceX, basically, they have now included SpaceX in that, whereas the S&P 500 did not. And so not everything is included in an index. And this is part of a passively managed portfolio, is that an index fund does not pick stocks. An index follows rules. So like, what are those rules? And basically in my research, and again, correct me if you think I'm wrong here, Jess, but there are basically three. So one is seasoning, right? So 12 months of public trading before you're eligible, right? So this is for the S&P 500, for example. Second is they have to be profitable, which makes sense, right? Why are you going to include a company on your index if it's not actually making money? It's losing money. And for the sum of the most recent 4 months, it needs to be profitable, and also the most recent quarter. And the third is float, which is a little into the weeds, but basically a minimum share of a company has to be trading based on this factor that's included in this process. And so it has to be around for long enough. It has to be making money. And then there's this weight that's provided in the index to basically say, hey, should we, based on these numbers and based on this data, include this in the index? And since the SpaceX IPO happened a month ago, 2 months ago, the S&P 500 says, no, like our inclusion criteria are 12 months. We're not going to do that. So we're not taking part. It's also, by the way, not profitable enough, I would imagine, to be in the S&P 500. However, there are other indices that follow different rules, to your point that you're making earlier, Justin, about like what is included. And so it's important to recognize that, say, for example, the total stock market index, which is based on a different set of rules, has included SpaceX in that. And that's because the NASDAQ 100, the Russell 1000, the CRSP, CRSP, as they call it in the financial world, have different rules. And so how SpaceX skipped the line for those, which some of those are what determine it being in a total stock market index fund, is that in May of 2026, the S&P Dow Jones, for example, said, hey, we're going to look into this. We're curious. And just happens to be right around the time SpaceX is coming out, right? What if we cut the seasoning window from 12 months to six? Or maybe we cut it less. What if we waive the profitability because a company has so much potential that we see the potential it has, so we're going to ignore the profitability requirements? And it turns out that on June 4th of 2026, 8 days before the IPO, Dow Jones said no. But other ones like the NASDAQ, CRSP, the Russell 1000, they said, you know what? We're going to make some special exceptions here. And to the extent where it used to be 12 months, and NASDAQ's like, you know what? If it's been trading for longer than 15 days, we're going to let it be included. Russell 1000 said 5 trading days. The CRSP, which is what determines the U.S. total stock market index fund. So if you're like, I'm a U.S. total stock market index fund guy, the CRSP said 5 days. If it's been trading for 5 days, we're not going to make it wait 12 months. And so they relaxed these requirements. So SpaceX joined the NASDAQ in July 7th of 2026. And it is now also included, based on the CRSP, in the Vanguard, for example, total stock market index fund, and the Fidelity total stock market index fund, and the Schwab total stock market index fund, which follow those same rules. And so I was curious though, Justin, because as I'm listening to this, the natural, as an investor, thought that popped into my head is like, should I transition my portfolio to be predominantly S&P 500 as opposed to total stock market index fund? Because the S&P has stricter criteria with theoretically better companies that are more proven on it than the one that follows the CRSP, the VTI, for example. And because the correlation's so high, I'm not sure from a mathematical standpoint how much of a benefit there really is there. But to your point, there may be some, because when these companies IPO and now they're included 5 days after they've been IPO'd and they tank, which often happens based on lots of studies, I don't know. Maybe this delta that you're talking about that's super small right now may actually be a larger delta now that we're letting companies that have been around for 5 days be involved in these index. Because a lot of the data that you're looking at is back when they were holding more stringent requirements for these indices, right?
Yeah, you rightly point out that these adjustments happened. And I think that it's an interesting corollary looking at private equity and healthcare. And that's like a common thing. Oh, these private equity companies. I have the same sort of like dogs bark, ducks quack, private equity buys and reorganizes the P&L and pushes on the revenue drivers. And I don't blame private equity.
People who run it's made
to do that. If you don't like the game, we need legislation to make that literally illegal. And similarly, when we're looking at Wall Street, like I don't view that as like shenanigans or corporate backroom dealing. I just think, yeah, everyone's trying to make money. Russell is worried if we don't have SpaceX and people want to own SpaceX, then they're going to go to the indices that include SpaceX, and we're going to be left out in the cold. So they're getting, I'm processing this, like they're getting FOMO the same way that the investors who are calling me saying, can I get into SpaceX, are feeling FOMO. Right. And so that is what it is. Interestingly, I was also looking at the SpaceX chart here since the go, and the 5 days, like in that 3 to 5 day window is basically the very apex of pricing. And that would be like the perfectly wrong time to include a stock based on
correct
in this example. And since then, it's down like 40%, which in the short term is funny to talk about. In the long term, you also talked about correlation. That's really helpful to understand. If we look at the CRSP and the S&P and the Russell 1000 and the MSCI US indices, these are all like 0.98 correlated to one another over long periods of time. That
or
means
higher.
Yeah, they're just like, if you created a stock chart and zoomed all the way out, it's just a bunch of overlapping lines that are on top of each other. So I think this is not material to the success of an individual investor over full economic cycles. I think it is interesting intellectually to understand the difference in construction. I believe that, again, to look at dimensional a little bit, there's factors of return that they explore. Like, what are the durable, observable dimensions of
growth or value?
Based growth on and value, you know, versus FAMA small. Research. Yes, exactly. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about individual companies. So I think, does it matter which index you choose? I would also point out, if we're talking about indices and your passive investing, like we're actually making active decisions by saying, I like the Russell better than the S&P or whatever. So I think that whole idea, it's helpful to understand like the control is with the investor. It's passive investing as itself is kind of a misnomer. I think like you, Jimmy, you have an idea about what you want for your future. You're going to make decisions. And even if you say, I literally want a total market portfolio that includes all of the stocks and all of the bonds at their global market cap weight, that is an active decision. And you could say, I'm a passive investor because I'm doing that. But I think we're talking about semantics now. So this should be empowering to investors to say, what is my target asset allocation? What kind of risk return profile is that going to give me based on historical returns? How do these indices or how do different financial instruments fit into that puzzle of creating the mosaic of component parts that I need to be diversified? And how is that going to get me where I need to go? So I think operating with those questions and then thinking about time horizon, thinking about the emotional experience of riding that roller coaster and what does that mean for you and your spouse if you're married? And are you going to be like losing sleep when you check your 401k statement? You got to know yourself and in some cases work with a professional. That's where the focus of an investor is productively spent. And then everything else just flows from that.
I think the academic question for me at the end of the day is based on these new, less stringent requirements. If the research 12 months, 2 years, 5 years from now shows the same as it does right now based on the older requirements, which were more stringent, and if there will be a bigger delta between the S&P, which maintained a more stringent requirement compared to these other ones that loosened up. The second thing is on an individual investor level, just FOMO. Right? Fear of missing out, you investing in SpaceX, seeing that as an opportunity and understanding how IPOs work, that the private investors are now wanting to make good on the money that they put in and that you as a public investor are typically the one that's providing them that return and that there's a good chance if you're investing directly right around an IPO that you're going to lose your shirt. Now, it's not always going to happen. There are some IPOs where people put in and they've just made bank ever since then. But you need to understand that when private markets become public, private companies, I should say, become public, that there are winners and losers, and that the winners are typically the private holders who've been holding for a very long time waiting for a liquidation event that this IPO has now provided. And so if you're sitting there listening to this episode and you've been a trooper and you're 30 minutes in, I would just tell you that IPOs are something that you need to be thoughtful about, that you need to probably get some professional help thinking through if you're considering investing in an opportunity like that, and that this is the first very large IPO, historically a large IPO, of some that are to come with the AI boom that's happening. Anthropic is going to drop at some point. The owners of ChatGPT, OpenAI, is going to drop at some point. And I can tell you right now that the way the IPOs go, those are going to be moments where you're like, but what if I don't invest in this momentous occasion in history? And your FOMO is going to drive you potentially to do things that you will later regret. And that maybe that's not the best way to decide what to invest in.
Another idea that it's helpful to explore is the idea of informational asymmetry. And in investing, you as an investor get to define the rules of engagement. you can define rules where you can win the game, or you can define rules where you're going to lose the game. And when your rules are defined by a single security, a short-term time horizon, I'm buying a security from institutional investors like Goldman Sachs, like JP Morgan, like the most smart, well-resourced, literally our mainframe is plugged into the Wall Street mainframe down on Wall Street types of organizations. They're selling you a thing. If they thought they could make a lot of money on that thing, they would hold it for longer, but they're selling it to you in order to get cash. So you're in that moment defining a game that you just, by definition, will never win. So my personal conviction about the IPO experience is you're defining a game with rules where you're just massively, you just will never understand as much as these huge companies that have been up in the guts of looking at all the numbers and all the projections and all the business strategies of these companies that they are bringing to public offering. And why would you play a game that you can't win when you would just, I know why, but it's FOMO. It's the problem of your sort of mechanical reaction, but instead play a long-term game and play a game you can win.
Yeah, the psychology of investing is huge. And don't enter a game where you do not have all the information and the person you're playing against has much more than you have. That is a great way to lose lots and lots of money. Completely agree. And so as we head out, I hope this was an academically interesting exercise in terms of how IPOs happen, how it impacts the index fund investing that's often touted in the space. If you want to learn more about some evidence-based ways of going about investing, don't forget you can get a free copy of The Physician Philosopher's Guide to Personal Finance, the book that I wrote for physicians in training and physicians who have just finished at moneymeetsmedicine.com/freebook. Otherwise, Justin and I, we'll see you next week. Cheers.
Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he helps anesthesiologists and pain medicine physicians. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing academic anesthesiologist at Wake Forest in North Carolina. He's also a licensed insurance agent. However, either Justin or Jimmy are your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only. Nothing should be considered financial advice. All views expressed are solely the views of the guests on the show and do not represent the views or opinions of their employer.
Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he provides financial advisory services for physicians and their families. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing anesthesiologist in North Carolina and a licensed insurance agent. However, neither Justin nor Jimmy is your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent, and nothing discussed on this show creates that kind of relationship. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only, and nothing should be considered financial, investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. The views expressed by the hosts and any guests are solely their own and do not represent the views or opinions of their employers, and their appearance on the show does not constitute an endorsement of their services. Before making any financial decisions, of course, consult your own financial, tax, or legal professional who understands your individual situation.